So, as some of you guys may know, the Friday episodes of this show are recorded earlier in the week. We cobble stuff together so you guys have something to chew on through the weekend. It's not designed to be a breaking news show, and yet there is indeed breaking news. A big landmark case from the Supreme Court that isn't Roe versus Wade. Instead, it is a fairly landmark case involving guns. And so before we even start this show that was recorded earlier in the week, I'm going to give you guys a bonus interview. Stephen Gutowski of The Reload joins me now to talk about exactly what is and is not in this ruling. Welcome back to the show, Stephen. Tell us about this ruling. What is it? What was the law that it was coming under that was coming under consideration by the Supreme Court, and what happened?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court on Thursday struck down New York's restrictive gun carry law as violating the Second Amendment through the 14th Amendment, because that's how they have incorporated the Bill of Rights to the states, is through the 14th Amendment. But anyway, it's found that New York's process for issuing gun carry permits was unconstitutional because that process included subjective judgments by state officials on whether or not the person applying had a, quote, good reason to need a permit. And so effectively it created this this standard that where it was, you could get a different result depending on different government officials looking at the same question. And in practice, of course, it severely limited the number of people who actually received concealed carry permits in the state. And so there's, according to the Supreme Court, there's six other states that have this kind of law, and they will obviously also have to rework their laws down the line in response to this. But more importantly, though, than that, although that will probably affect about 25% of the country, because even though it's only six states, happens to be some of the largest states, New York, the California.
Most populous states. Yeah.
Yeah. So it isn't insignificant on its own, the direct ruling in the case, but what's perhaps more significant is the standard that they have now created for gun cases going forward, or I shouldn't say created, more like elaborated upon.
Yeah.
So, you know, Heller in 2008 was sort of the landmark ruling on the Second Amendment from the Supreme Court that established it was an individual right to keep and bear arms. And so they laid out their reasoning and how they came to that conclusion in that case. And for the next, 14 years, it's been quite a while now. There have been complaints from gun rights advocates that lower courts have been more or less ignoring the standards that they put together in Heller. And in this case, Bruin, this New York case, the Supreme Court, if the majority effectively agreed with that and looked at the standard that a lot of lower courts have been using to uphold gun laws over the last decade plus, and criticized it and said it's not acceptable. And instead that you have to, when judging gun cases, you have to look at the text of the Second Amendment and then the sort of historical tradition of gun regulations from the time period where the Second Amendment was adopted, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So this not only affects immediately all these states that, from my understanding, and I was reading your coverage and a few other people, the line here is shall permit versus may permit. Yes. Is that the terminology with
yeah.
The, With the difference being that may permit is you do everything that they ask you to do. You submit your form to the government and they may say, OK, you can have a concealed carry permit. Shall permit is you, as long as everything checks out on your requirements, they shall do it. And then there's constitutional carry, which is congratulations. When you were born, you were allowed to conceal carry.
Right. That's the basic breakdown. I mean, constitutional carry or permitless carry, you have to be legally allowed to possess a gun to carry it, obviously. So you can't be, a felon or or domestic violence misdemeanor convictions or things like that, that would prevent you from buying guns in the first place. But yeah, that's a good breakdown. That's basically how that works out. And so I should note that the court didn't strike down shall issue permits. So you can still regulate gun yes. carry in the United States. It's just, you can't use the may issue standard that has this like subjective aspect to it. You could, the shall issue permits are perfectly fine. And that's, well, right now, permitless carry is the dominant form. That 25 states now have that, but the rest of them, other than these six, are shall issue. So most of the laws aren't going to change on a numerical basis. And, you know, 75% of the country won't experience any effects, but the other 25% where the, you know, in these six states, they'll probably get a shall issue law sometime in the near future is what's the likely outcome.
So let me just roll back here, because I think that at least in some of the reaction to this, it seems like people are getting a little confused. This was not about buying a gun.
No,
this was about what you can do or can't do with the gun outside of your home. Right.
Yes. Yeah. And if you're getting like down to the very base level of what this does, Heller was about owning guns inside of your own home.
Okay.
And so it established, you know, the base level of what you can do inside your own home, which is to own the most common form of gun used for self-defense. That's what Heller was saying, which is handguns.
Because yeah.
Heller was about a total ban on handgun ownership. This is about what you can do with a gun, the base level, outside of your home. So at the very least, the state has to, you know, have a regulation that, you know, if you can prove that you have the training they want and you pass the background check, they have to give you that permit at the very least. And you know, Roberts and Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence that sort of emphasized this even further. Like, shall issue laws are fine. Shall issue permitting is acceptable. The Second Amendment is not literally an unlimited right that you can't have any yeah. regulations on. There are a lot of different ways you can regulate the Second Amendment, just not in this particular way.
I wonder whether or not, you know, trying to predict the next move, because Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, was apoplectic in her press conference about this and said she was going to call a legislative session. I wonder if immediately after reading the coverage of the ruling, or maybe it was one of the concurrences that said, you know, that you are allowed as the government to designate safe spaces or certain yes. places for which you are not allowed to bring a gun, which immediately made me think, you know, like, okay, well, is the New York legislative session going to declare New York State a safe space?
Well, the ruling actually does directly talk about that.
Okay.
And effectively says, like, yes, you can make, you know, just sort of, you hear when you talk about the First Amendment, you hear time, place, manner restrictions, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing is true for Second Amendment, basically, yeah. is what they're getting at. So you can restrict where people carry guns. So sensitive places like schools or court buildings or, you know, things of that nature, maybe government offices, you know, can be restricted. That's consistent with what the court is saying. But you can't just it can't just be a broad blanket. Like the entire, in the ruling, Thomas says, like, or it might be Alito in the concurrence, but either way, they just say, you know, yeah, you can have these sensitive places, but the entire island of Manhattan can't be one.
Yeah.
So yeah, they've kind of already addressed that, but the way this has worked out.
That's why I joked on the Patreon episode that I did right after this came out, that it's going to be like, okay, Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens are safe spaces. Right, Staten Island right. and the Bronx, you're on your own.
Right. And look, just because they're going to lose in court doesn't necessarily mean that New York or some of these other states won't pass laws that don't fit with this ruling. Like,
sure.
It'll probably take a while to get down to like what you can and can't do. I mean, honestly, we already have a template for this, because DC and Illinois are ahead of the curve here, because they had their laws struck down by federal courts
yeah.
a while back, and they instituted their own shall issue laws. DC went through a whole progression. They had total ban on any kind of carry. There was no permitting at all. They didn't even have may issue, right? Mm-hmm. Then that got struck down. Then they passed a may issue law, like what New York and Maryland
okay.
and and Massachusetts have. And then that got struck down. And then they finally passed a shall issue law. Now, their shall issue law, though, is probably the strictest shall issue law in the country, because their training requirements are, you know, 16 hours of training with that includes range time, even though DC doesn't actually have a public range that you can go to. So you'll have to go outside the jurisdiction to actually do that training.
Yeah.
And then they have a lot of these areas that are off limits to carrying, more so than most other jurisdictions. So the public transit, for one, which, you know, if you don't have a car, makes it kind of difficult to legally carry a gun in DC, even if you have a permit. But also things like permitted events or events that should be permitted. So if there's a large gathering of people, basically, you can't carry. Virginia has instituted that as well. So that's kind of becoming a new thing. That's maybe going to test the limits of this, but DC has a special one for diplomats. So if there's a diplomatic convoy, somebody who's under protection,
they're allowed to carry a gun. Yeah.
You're not allowed, even if you're permitted, to carry a gun within a certain distance of them.
Oh, wow.
And they travel around the city. So they kind of have these roaming gun-free zones that pop up. Now, I think in practice, they have to like warn you first before they can just arrest you. Yeah. Otherwise you'd have to like run away from them.
It would be a very odd game of a tag. Yeah.
But that gives you an idea.
I wonder. Yeah. That if everything is now shall permit, I do also wonder if now the line of what you need to do to get a gun will go up in response to this.
But it'll have to be an objective standard that applies to everybody.
Yeah.
Is sort of the bottom line. And then, the federal courts will probably, there'll be litigation over all that, I'm sure. Whether it makes it all, the Supreme Court's probably just going to stick to broad based issues. Like, if New York institutes, like, you have to have an hour or a year of training before you can get a permit. Sure. That's probably going to get tossed very quickly by the Supreme Court. But if it's like, DC requires 16 hours. All right, New York, we're going to require 18 hours.
Yeah.
Is the Supreme Court going to step in there? Probably not. You'll have to wait and see exactly how it plays out. But my guess is these states that have may issue laws will end up like DC, where they have shall issue, but it's on the high end of what the requirements are. And they probably won't have reciprocity with other states. So if you have a Pennsylvania concealed carry license, it won't be good in New Jersey or New York still. That's not part of this ruling. They don't have to recognize these other permits, but they probably won't issue permits to people who live outside the state either, would be another guess. That's where I think things will.
That's down the road. Those are the next fights. In the interim, Hochul did mention, I believe it was either Hochul or Mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, who mentioned that their public transit would likely be designated safe spaces. So much, totally. Much in the same way that DC does. All right. Well, anything else that would otherwise slip under the radar of this decision from your point of view?
Well, I think that just the most important thing to keep in mind is those are the immediate impacts of this ruling. And they'll be on these gun carry laws and regulation over that. But there's a likelihood that you'll see much broader impacts down the line from that change in how courts are supposed to decide Second Amendment cases. And that's going to have a much broader impact, I think, because basically it calls into question a lot of modern gun regulations that have been put into place since the 20th century. Like, if they don't have an analog that goes back to the founding era or even to, the 14th Amendment's adoption, they're going to become much more scrutinized, I think, now.
There's now a legal plan of attack for organizations like the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association to bring cases against these laws because of the guidance set out by the Supreme Court in this ruling.
Yeah, it's much more specific now than it was in Heller. And it also rebukes the steps that places like the Ninth Circuit have been using, the standards they've been using to uphold these kinds of laws.
Yeah.
So they'll have to, not that that's going to mean that the Ninth Circuit is immediately going to start ruling like the 6-3 Supreme Court rules. They might find some other manner to uphold laws. I think that's pretty likely, but But it'll be much more difficult. And, you know, the Supreme Court's still honestly going to have to step in more than every decade if they want to, you know, sort of swat down what some of the lower courts are doing in regards to gun law, gun litigation. But it represents a major opportunity for gun rights advocates in this realm, for sure.
Well, most likely it'll be the second most talked about Supreme Court ruling, at least in terms of the press leading into it. Thank you, Stephen Gutowski of The Reload. Please go read his work, both on this and the gun rights bill. I think that you've done really excellent stuff. And for folks who just kind of want a paint by numbers breakdown of what these things are, what they mean, and the relevant quotes from the people that are guiding these subjects, I think your writing is excellent on that. So everybody go check that out.
Thank
you very much, Stephen.
Appreciate it.
And with that, back to our previously recorded episode, already in progress.
The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics, Politics, Politics podcast for June 24th, 2022. Your old pal, Justin Robert Young, joining you. We've got a couple big stories. One that is looking to 2024 and another that will almost certainly have some kind of effect on 2022. Ron DeSantis versus Donald Trump has been in the news over the last few days. We will dissect why and whether or not it matters. And currently making its way through the mechanisms of the Senate and eventually the House en route to the desk of Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. is the first piece of gun legislation that the United States has seen in over 30 years. What is in it? And what will be the arguments about it before it becomes law, which I suspect it will. And we will have a conversation with Tom Merritt, talking about all things tech, including whether or not TikTok needs to worry about more regulation efforts. And a conversation that started when I was in my normal guest slot on his program, Daily Tech News Show, about when is something secret and when is it public, specifically from a technological perspective? This is something that is of great interest to the FCC because there are rules permitting a political action committee from communicating directly or privately with a campaign. And yet, thanks to the internet, things can technically be public without them being, you know, easy to find. All that. Before we start, though, I want to bring to your attention, a Florida man story for his age. Andrew Gillum. Longtime listeners to this show remember Andrew Gillum's name because we were very dialed in to his race against Ron DeSantis. Old heads will remember that both Gillum and DeSantis were underdogs in their primaries. They both won. This is in 2018, and then had a really, really, really tough fight. Rick Scott did not leave a particularly popular governor in Florida as a Republican, and so electing another Republican was going to be a challenge, specifically in a bit of a blue wave situation. And yet, despite the fact that there were whispers that Andrew Gillum was under investigation for campaign issues, money issues, he came within a half a point of beating Ron DeSantis. Talk about a sliding doors moment if Gillum had beaten DeSantis, especially what we're about to talk about in this episode. Since then, well, brother, things have not been kind to Gillum. He was getting the, you know, kind of Stacey Abrams treatment at the beginning. Sure, you lost, but it was close. What a shining new star we have found. Let's put him on CNN. Let's have him write a book. Oh, my God. Andrew Gillum was found in a South Beach hotel room with an overdose victim. And one of the people that talked about to the police what happened was a male escort whose email address included the phrase honey hammock. Well, Gillum continues to fall downhill. Indeed, he was indicted on Wednesday on several charges, the same thing that folks were worried about he was going to be indicted for when he was running for office damn near 4 years ago. Great Florida man moments. Andrew Gillum, this podcast salutes you. But first, so let's start here with Ron DeSantis. Politico says that he is not going to seek an endorsement from Donald J. Trump for his re-election bid in Florida. That is the 2022 race that Ron DeSantis is currently involved in. This is the exact verbiage according to Politico. According to people connected with the governor and the former president, DeSantis has not asked Trump for a formal endorsement and isn't planning to. It's a clear sign that DeSantis, who more than 4 years ago was a little-known congressman from northeastern Florida, has risen high in the GOP stratosphere. Now, immediately, this kind of set off alarm bells. DeSantis and Trump are tied at the hip. It was Trump's endorsement of DeSantis, and specifically DeSantis's courting of it, that really put him on the map, that made him not just another Rick Scott Republican. Ron DeSantis cut one of the most emasculating ads I have ever seen in politics, wherein he was teaching his child lessons about how to be a good person like Donald Trump, including building a wall with baby blocks. So, why is this story out there? What is happening? Is this a preemptive strike because Trump wasn't going to offer DeSantis an endorsement? We've heard some kind of off-the-record sniping between the two of them. Well, not according to this Politico story. The Politico story says that DeSantis would get the endorsement should he seek one. I have the hairs on the back of my neck sticking up with this. And I'm going to get to why by the end of the segment. But let's just flag right here that I don't think the existence of this article precludes Trump from endorsing DeSantis or anything along those lines. But I got more theories. Let's keep driving down the idea that Donald Trump is possibly distancing himself from somebody that might be a head-to-head competitor in the 2024 Republican primary. And this story ran on Wednesday when another piece of information that could heighten that paranoia also came out. Here's a University of New Hampshire poll. Nikki Haley, 6%. Mike Pence, 9%. Donald Trump, 37%. And Ron DeSantis, 39%. Furthermore, with general election voters, they have DeSantis up 1 on Joe Biden in a hypothetical matchup, and Trump -7 against Joe Biden This is the first time in a major primary poll Ron DeSantis has pulled ahead of Donald Trump. Previously, Donald Trump has been the unquestioned leader of the Republican Party by all available polling. Ron DeSantis, the head of an if Trump doesn't run category. But now, Big Chungus versus Captain Ron. Well, it looks as if, at least in the Granite State, those folks are warming up more to the governor of Florida than the 45th president. But let me get to what I have heard whispered. Some of these whispers have been from people that might know. Some of these whispers have been from random bartenders who told me things that seemed like they made a little bit of sense because of connections they had. But this is consistent, at least amongst the whispers. And here's what I heard. Totally unconfirmed, unreported on rumor. Okay, so just put on your tinfoil hat and provide any qualifiers that you might want. But here's what I've heard. There is no rift between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump. In fact, they are on the exact same page. And that page is this. Ron DeSantis is going to run for president in 2024. Donald Trump will not. So why is Donald Trump out here hinting about how he's going to run for president? And you have all these rumors of, is he going to announce before the midterms or after the midterms? Here's why. Because Donald Trump can't raise money to fund the races he wants to fund and continue to run the political operation that he does now if he says he isn't running. As we all know on this show, all power is future power. So he's got to say he's doing it until he says he doesn't. So do I believe that? Well, if I did, then it would mean that stories like this are being deliberately leaked to the press so there can be a little bit of intrigue between these two candidates, and at the very least, they could solidify themselves as the top two in that no doubt crowded primary field, considering how weak Joe Biden is, if indeed he runs. But I don't know. I'd sooner try and jump over the moon than understand what Donald Trump is thinking. I do believe that Ron DeSantis is definitely running. And I also buy that he's becoming a more popular politician than Trump. If just because Ron DeSantis has a record on things that have happened within the last 2 years, Donald Trump doesn't. And he's not even staying in the public eye in the same kind of way because he doesn't have social media. So while he will always be a focus of the Democrats, because the Democrats want and desperately need and miss him, I don't think for Republicans, they want to hear about 2020 drop boxes and 2,000 mules. They want to hear about the inflation rate and critical race theory. That's what Ron DeSantis has done. He is a magnet for the moment. And as much as I like to joke about the fact that he's got trigger laws on the books for anything that's in the A block of Tucker Carlson, that is something that makes him vibrant, that makes him current, that makes him now. He's so 2000 and late. Trump is 2008. If I were to bet, I would say that Donald Trump endorses Ron DeSantis and they both say that the news is fake. Beyond that, it's anybody's guess. But if they both run, oh boy, do we have a heavyweight contest that is going to last for a while. And the beautiful thing about both of those political battle machines is that they are not afraid about trading paint. They will go at each other very hard. Ooh, just got a shiver up the back of my spine. The bipartisan gun bill has begun making its way through the Senate. It will eventually make its way through the House. It will face some resistance there, but the Democrats have enough votes to advance it. It's going to hit the desk of Joe Biden, and Joe Biden is going to sign it into law. This is the product of Kyrsten Sinema, John Thune, John Cornyn, and Tom Tillis. I'm going to crib notes here from our guest the other day, Stephen Gutowski of The Reload. I can't recommend his work highly enough. He writes in a very plain style that I very much appreciate and is very good about laying out issues that I know for many of us, we are not devout followers of the Second Amendment issues and debates unless there is some kind of horrifying issue at hand. So I greatly appreciate and I recommend that you go to thereload.com and read his breakdown if you want a more detailed version of what I'm about to give you. But this is what is actually in the bill, right? Not the framework, not the no more dot, dot, dots. This is what's in the bill. First things first, it will be made illegal for anyone to knowingly sell guns or ammunition to anyone who has a juvenile record that includes felony conviction, domestic violence, misdemeanor conviction, or an involuntary commitment after the age of 16. Until now, those prohibitions only applied to adult records. The bill creates a special background check process for 18 to 20-year-olds. Under the special under this special process, the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, would be required to contact the Juvenile Criminal Record System in the buyer's state, the state's mental health record custodian, and, quote, a local law enforcement agency, unquote, where the buyer lives to check for disqualifying juvenile records. NICS then has 3 days to tell the gun dealer whether it found cause to further investigate the buyer's background. If so, NICS can then take up to 10 days to do an investigation. At that point, the gun can be sold, even if NICS has not made a determination. That is standard procedure as of now, the way I understand that law. The process is similar to the current procedure for when NICS identifies potential disqualifying records and doesn't have immediate access to those situations. The text says that NICS must return a result on whether it found reason to believe the buyer has disqualifying juvenile records as soon as possible, but the new process appears likely to result in sales for 18 to 20-year-olds being delayed more often. The entire specialized background check process is set to expire after 10 years. However, disqualifying juvenile records will still remain in NICS after that point. So I'm going to pause here and say the one thing that is confusing to me about that is it's 18 to 21 year olds that will have their juvenile stuff in there. I wonder whether or not if you don't try and buy a gun at 21, then does that get added to your file? I'm not sure. I'll have to do more research here. Moving on. The bill expands the definition of domestic violence. So this is the boyfriend loophole you might have heard of. That now will be referred to as quote-unquote dating relationships. It applies to anyone who is convicted of a misdemeanor violent attack. They are or recently were in a, and I'm quoting here, a continuing serious relationship of a romantic or intimate nature. The text says whether the relationship falls under this definition will be determined by its length, nature, as well as quote, frequency and type of interaction between those involved. It specifically rejects any, quote, casual acquaintanceships or ordinary fraternization in a business or social context as part of the definition. So I'm going to pause on the reading here. The boyfriend loophole was criticized because and the way the law stands now, if you're convicted of a domestic violence incident, with somebody that you either live with, are married to, or have kids with, then you are not allowed to buy a gun. The boyfriend loophole was, okay, well, what happens if you are all but married, but you don't live together and you don't have kids? That's the boyfriend loophole. So this is looking to close that. The fight that was happening with this specific language leading up to it was, well, exactly what constitutes a boyfriend and what stops that from being your work boyfriend, from being your best friend, from being somebody else, blah, blah, blah. We go back to the reading. And additionally, anyone barred under the new dating relationship provision would also be automatically eligible for their record to be expunged and removed from the background check system after 5 years if they don't commit any further crimes during that time period. The clemency would not extend to misdemeanor domestic violence offenses against spouses or children that are already prohibited for life under federal law. The expungement of dating partner records appear to be part of the concessions made to Cornyn and other Republicans during negotiations. His request to expand funding intended to encourage states to adopt red flag laws out of other kinds of state crisis intervention programs made it into the final deal as well. All right. Speaking of red flag laws, here's what's in it about that. States can request grant money for crisis intervention programs, including, quote, mental health courts, drug courts, and veterans courts instead of red flag programs. Additionally, in order for a red flag law to qualify for funding, it has to include due process rights that prevent any violation or infringement of the Constitution and, quote, have any evidentiary standard in line with a similar federal court proceeding and penalties for, quote, abuse of the program. And finally, last 2 points here. The bill creates a new and potentially redundant crime for purchasing guns for others who can't legally own them for gun trafficking. Both of those offenses are already illegal under federal law, although critics often complain about low prosecution rates associated with current prohibitions. If you remember our conversation with Stephen a few weeks ago, or last week rather, this is a bugaboo for legal gun owners, is that what's the point of creating new laws if we're not enforcing the laws we currently have? Finally, the deal reworks the standard for when people legally selling firearms are required to obtain a federal license. The standard will be changed from those who sell guns, quote, with the principal objective of livelihood and profit to those who sell, quote, predominantly to, quote, earn a profit. The text further defines that as somebody who sells guns with the goal of obtaining a pecuniary gain instead of somebody who has the goal of improving or liquidating a personal firearms collection. Look, red flag laws and the boyfriend loophole are probably the two biggest sticking points. Any kind of qualification to what some voters assume to be a constitutional right is going to be something that will have pushback. I suspect that this will get pretty loud on the right, that John Cornyn will get a lot of crap. John Cornyn is very pumped that he does not have to face a reelection for another 5 years. And I think that that'll be about it. I don't think that red flag laws are necessarily going to be something that we talk a lot about, largely because a lot of states have them and they are not the house on fire situation that I think some folks on the two-way side are making this out to be, especially considering the fact that voters in red states will still have control over exactly what laws go in and whether or not they want to prohibit them. I think that the most political action you are going to see on this are local politicians, state politicians saying that they will never have a red flag law and that being a way to politically virtue signal. And then that'll be that. And look, I might be have political brainworms, but I kind of think that this is more of a win for the senators that put this together than it is consequential to the American people. I think it's still going to be plenty easy to get a gun. And ultimately, the blue states will make it really annoying and the red states will make it very easy. But for John Cornyn, for Kyrsten Sinema, for Thune, for Tillis, I think this sets them up as power players, especially Kyrsten Sinema. Keep an eye on that one. Ladies and gentlemen, this show only exists because of you. You who head to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world today. Inflation is no joke. The price of food is no joke. The price of gas is no joke. The rent is going up. It's expensive to fly around. And yet, knowing all that, the fact that any of you decide to peel off just a little bit so you can support independent political analysis, that you can fund my hunt to look for new and clarifying voices on the subjects for which you have endless, mind-numbing, stupid content produced about. It just makes me very happy. It makes me very happy that I can make my living doing this. It makes me happy that when I'm going to leave for a few weeks, I get to pay talented people to be here for you so you don't miss a second of your content that you have come to expect. It makes me happy that I'm going to go to Wyoming and cover Liz Cheney's primary. It makes me happy that I'm definitely going back to Pennsylvania so I can see Oz and Fetterman. That I might go to some of these other Senate hotbed seats. Might have to go back to Georgia. See Raphael Warnock, Herschel Walker. All of that exists because you want it to. Thank you. $3 tier gets you two bonus podcasts each and every week. In fact, this was something that Heaton told me the other day, just to put the context in, that, you know, look, $3 a week is something that is, you know, when you add it up for the month, yeah, it's $12. It's more than you pay for certain streaming services and stuff like that. But think about it like this. If four times a week I was just in your car, just a dude telling you about all the stuff I found out about politics over the last few days, I did that four times a week. Would one of those four days, if I asked you to buy me a cup of coffee, would you do it? I think most of you would. And if you do that, well, it's even easier to do it via Patreon and TakePoliticsSeriously.com. That's really all it is. Now, of course, if you want to take it to the next level, you can do the $10 tier. You can get your name read at the end of this show. So I would say at the end of sitting in all of your cars, I would say the name of everybody who bought me, you know, a cup of coffee and one of those expensive little snack boxes from Starbucks. It's just that simple. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Thank you very much. Our guest today needs no explanation. He is the Dean of Tech News, an internet pioneer, and no doubt a Hall of Famer in the world of podcasting. It's not a joke. He's actually in the Hall of Fame. The one, the only, Daily Tech News Show's Tom Merritt. Welcome to the show, Tom.
It's wonderful to be back.
TikTok. Boy, howdy. There was that moment during 2020 when we thought that they might be banned. They were going to have all of their data processed via Oracle. Trump loses the election. Everyone forgets about it. And then the old Wall Street Journal reporting internal deliberations within TikTok that might restart some of these same fears that it is a Chinese spyware app.
Yes. Yes. I suggested to Justin that he just do what any good engineer would do and make this object oriented and point to our conversations from 2020 and just use an include tag on that. But then there's a few other wrinkles here that, yeah, that weren't around back then. So yeah, they BuzzFeed, Wall Street Journal are both reporting on recorded conversations from within TikTok about U.S. data.
Yeah.
The thing that's actually happening is that they are going to use Oracle servers to store U.S. private data.
Okay.
Now, let's set the expectation right up top.
This was set up from that 2020 kerfuffle. So that did go through.
It follows on from that. The 2020 kerfuffle was going to have like Oracle own a piece of the company and all that part is gone. But Oracle did end up with a contract out of this.
Hey, look at that.
Hey, you know, so that ain't bad for Oracle. And when we're talking private information, we're talking about your phone number, your birthday, maybe your email address. It's not a lot. Let's be clear, like anything that's publicly information, like your username, the videos you post, the things you like, anybody could see, that's not part of this. This is just the stuff that you wouldn't make public is going to be stored on Oracle's data center in the United States. That's a slight difference from what has happened before, which was it was stored on ByteDance servers in Singapore and the US. So this is ByteDance doesn't own the servers. They're renting them from Oracle and it's only going to be in the US. They're going to have backups in Singapore for a while, but the point is eventually migrate it all over to Oracle. Now, according to BuzzFeed, this is just bare metal, which means ByteDance is still running all their own software. Oracle's not involved in running the software. Oracle's just providing the space on the servers and the security that protects them.
Yeah.
But otherwise, this is just ByteDance doing a copy, you know, an image, like take the server that we had at our ByteDance server in Santa Monica and send it over there to that Oracle server over there.
Now, let's just rewind a little bit for folks that have not followed this story as closely as we have. The worry here is that ByteDance, a Chinese company, that anything that goes to ByteDance-owned servers, no matter where they are in the world, are going to, because of how companies work in China and fears justified or otherwise, that the Chinese government can effectively demand whatever they want from any company in China at any time through either direct channels or indirect pressure, that American data should be stored here because it would be further siloed away from that pressure, right?
Yeah, whenever I try to pin down what the actual fears are, they sort of tend to boil down to, but China, because honestly, Apple, Microsoft, even Google, they don't run their search engine in China, but they had ad sales offices there, Facebook, everybody in the US is in China and is storing data in China. They don't store US data in China.
They store Chinese data in China.
They don't store Chinese data anywhere else but China.
Yeah.
However, if you're really worried about the Chinese government getting access to data, I guess you would be worried that they would demand access, not whether it's in the country. In other words, could someone from the Chinese government go and say that Tom Merritt said mean things about us on Daily Tech News Show? Give me all his data. It doesn't matter if my data is stored in China or on Oracle servers. If the person they're talking to in China can tippity tap, pull it up and hand it over. Right. It doesn't matter what server is on. So there's a lot in these articles about having conversations of who's allowed to access it.
Gotcha.
Because if only U.S. TikTok employees can access it, then it's a lot harder for a Chinese official to force them to do it. If it's a Chinese citizen that has access to it, then there's a lot more pressure that they can use and legal things that they can use. That's where the story to me becomes companies that grow really fast don't always know where all their data goes and how all their tools work, because person who wrote tool may not work there anymore. That's what I get from a lot of these smoking gun conversations is not, well, we found that there was a back door that could be used. What we hear is like, I don't know. There's a lot of things in this tool. I don't understand what they do. And they could be used as backdoors, which I'm not saying that that's great, but that's also not unusual in companies that have grown as fast as TikTok to be like, hey, we built a lot of tools. Some of the functions we asked for are still in there, and we're not sure who has access to those functions anymore. So there's a lot to unwind. It doesn't mean there isn't anything nefarious going on, but it also isn't evidence that there is.
Where is TikTok in the landscape of social media companies? Because it feels like we are, you know, not even in the settling and maturing element of our social media world. We are long past the world of everlasting growth for everybody, and everything is chaotic and we have no idea where the ceiling is. Feel like we've found the ceiling, and now companies are not only being forced to grow up and be profitable, but also in the case of Twitter, seems to have hit the end of the road of not being an object for sale, for which they have kind of been rumored about forever.
Yeah, I think that is where the conversation of TikTok tends to not go in the direction that I would think would be most concerning. TikTok is growing. TikTok is making more and more money. TikTok is making the moves it needs to move to do to make money, including trying to integrate shopping, trying to facilitate easier brand deals for people. I have a good friend who makes good money on TikTok, but TikTok doesn't get any cut of it, because all of his brand deals go directly to the sponsors. And TikTok is doing some smart things to say like, okay, maybe that works for that person, but you know, we can make it so that we will get a cut of some of these deals going forward, et cetera, et cetera. So TikTok is on the rise. TikTok is something to look at as a growing company versus Twitter and even Facebook that have sort of stagnated. And where TikTok could be most threatening is not with your private information. To be honest, if China wants to find out any of that private information, my phone number, my email address, my home address, whatever, they can buy it from a data broker. It's out there. It got leaked in some other site somewhere. They don't need to go put a legal order. In fact, it would be one of the more difficult ways to get that data would be to try to get it out of ByteDance. What they could do, though, is say to TikTok, to ByteDance, we would like your algorithm to nudge this message a little more and nudge this message a little less. Because the magic of TikTok, if you haven't used it, is that you don't pick what you see. While you do follow people, and there is a tab of people that you're following that you can look at, what most people look at is what's called the For You tab, which is, we've noticed what you seem to like, let's give you more of that.
With apologies to the South African Sams and the Auntie Donna troupe, it knows what you want because you lingered. You lingered, Mark. You lingered.
Exactly. In fact, it's kind of spooky if you ever use it, how quickly it catches on and you can steer it. I used to get a lot of iPhone tips because I looked up an iPhone tip once. Then my wife started posting regularly and I started liking her stuff. And suddenly I was getting a lot of stuff that was similar to what she was posting. So it can adapt. And that's something that moving the US data to Oracle servers isn't going to do anything about, right? There's no transparency into the algorithm, and because it's a proprietary company, and that is the value of their business, is that algorithm.
Well, you've done a very good job, as you always do on Daily Tech News Show, for which, by the way, somebody pointed out, and I do need to do the disclosure, since we are always very good at disclosures. I kind of assumed everybody who's listening to this show knows that I am a regular contributor on Daily Tech News Show. But if you did not know that I am a regular contributor and Tom pays me money weekly to be on the show, then know that I get paid to be on Daily Tech News Show. That being said,
Well, I think we should also disclose, Justin, that I don't get paid to be on here now.
You don't. In fact, I often hit up Tom within 24 hours notice of relying on a personal favor to have him give me free content.
I'm not trying to throw Justin under the bus. No. I just, you know, for purposes of open disclosure.
Although I guess we can say now that I announced Bill Scheer was going to be one of our guest hosts while I'm out of the country. Another guest host will be Tom Merritt, and you will get paid for that.
And we'll get paid for that. So yeah. I will say whatever Justin wants me to say when he's paying me that time.
So follow me beyond your sober technical analysis down the rabbit hole of the political world, because there was no doubt that TikTok became a political thing during a presidential season. It was a culture war issue of, aren't you worried, you know, that your kids are spending too much time on this mysterious app that you don't know so much about? Did you know it was owned by China? China was an issue that both Donald Trump and Joe Biden were hawks on. So the idea of going after TikTok was something that for voting members of society was a fairly slam dunk kind of thing. Now we find ourselves 2 years later. You've got a president that is underwater in a lot of key metrics, specifically underwater with parents, many of whom are upset for various educational issues, some resulting to the lockdown, some about more culture war stuff. Boy, would it be a sister soldier moment for Joe Biden to all of a sudden rekindle some of his China hawk energy and say, no, you want to know what? I do think TikTok should be banned.
I doubt he does that. That is a move that only one president seems to have the courage to make, and a move that was made simply for the effect. I imagine that people organizing on TikTok to sign up for a rally they didn't go to try to embarrass him may have played a little bit.
I think that was overblown, and that was the issue in Tulsa.
I think the bigger deal is China owns this very popular app. It's also very popular with a lot of people who aren't in my base. And whenever that happens, people are suspicious. Why is that so popular? I don't use it. What is it really doing? Also, with technology, you can say a lot of things like, but the data is in their hands. And that can mean 1,000 different things, but you don't have to specify to make people pay attention and go, well, I don't like the data being in their hands. So it's ready made for some kind of controversy. On the other hand, if the sitting president Joe Biden were to try to ban TikTok, a lot of his base loves TikTok. A lot of his base does understand TikTok, and I think it would be quite unpopular for him to try to ban TikTok.
Oh, I think it would be unpopular, but much in the same way that it was unpopular for Bill Clinton to criticize a rap artist. You know, when he's counting on a lot of black votes, he did.
I'm not
it
sure
so
how much
build-
bump he gets from the Democratic base, similar to what President Trump got from the Republican base.
Yeah, I think it would be independents. It would be people for whom are just upset at the Democratic Party for various other reasons, largely because they are raising kids and they don't feel like their kids are being raised in the right place. And so if you do a thing that is specifically for them, this is like school uniforms or something like that.
The problem is when President Trump went after TikTok, the demo was still very young and a lot of people didn't understand it. I think in the past couple of years, more adults have gotten onto TikTok and more adults enjoy it and think of it as their happy place. I had a friend of mine who is older than me tell me the other day, TikTok is their happy place. So I don't know that they get the same effect. In fact, I don't even know if President Trump would get the same effect.
So then let's get back to where it wound up with Trump, because as much as there was a lot of Sturm und Drang about, oh, it's going to be banned on Friday, get your final For You page sessions in, it never was. And it wound up getting back to this larger thing that I did wonder whether or not it was a trend, specifically in a climate that is unfriendly, or at least does not business-wise look at China as the world of infinite growth. And I do think that that has changed also over the last 2 years.
That's
true. That beyond manufacturing, China was once looked at both in tech and entertainment as, wow, a billion people that we could sell American entertainment to? Let's do it. And American technology too? And you can. But you got to play by China's rules. And China, the belief that, oh, they'll soften, they'll let us keep pushing things, they'll let us own more of things, they'll let us distribute more stuff there. No, we have found the edge of where China will allow things to go.
Oh, yeah. President Xi turned that boat around, right?
Yes.
It was happening. And it would have been, in my opinion, what do I know? In my opinion, would have been smart for China to continue to soften and manage that slow transition. President Xi differed and has taken the country in an entirely different direction that doesn't allow for that kind of softening that you're talking about.
So then the question became, and this is where it ended with TikTok, is, okay, well then why aren't we making China play by China's rules? Why do we have more of a lax opportunity for them to not mandatorily partner with an American company? And that's where the Oracle, you know, like sell half of TikTok to Oracle stuff came.
It was a little bit of like, what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yes.
Fine. If you're going to do that, then we'll make your big company do that. The difference is we're not putting it as a policy. All Chinese companies must do that because there are too many Chinese companies that we like.
Yeah.
You never hear, even when you're talking about Huawei, which we single-handedly crippled. If you don't know, the United States put sanctions on Huawei that prevent anyone, including companies in other countries, from selling any kind of chip or technology to make chips to Huawei, specifically Huawei, even if that intellectual property or any of that technology has roots in the U.S. So TSMC, a Taiwanese company, can't sell chips to a Chinese mainland company because TSMC is using intellectual property that's licensed through companies in the United States. We allowed Huawei to sell off its cell phone brand Honor, but that's still a Chinese company.
Yeah.
And Honor is still making phones and they're selling phones and using Google's stock Android. And we didn't go after Honor. We went after ZTE, but we didn't go after a lot of other companies like Xiaomi. In fact, the biggest one I like to bring up is Lenovo. People think of Lenovo as, oh yeah, it's the old IBM laptops under a different name. And yes, Lenovo does have a headquarters in the United States, very similar to ByteDance and TikTok.
Yep.
But Lenovo is a Chinese company, and no one ever goes after Lenovo the same way because it doesn't win you points to go after Lenovo. People think of Lenovo as good, solid laptops, which they are.
Yeah. So you don't think that there is any possible return to the good for the goose, good for the gander, unless I guess with the caveat that, let's say we have a Ukraine situation with Taiwan in a year or something.
That would change all the rules. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I think at that point we would probably see some tightening.
Well, Lenovo suffers if that happens. Like everybody, that changes everything. But yeah, assuming that nothing dramatic like that changes, which these days seems like a really bad idea to assume that things won't change. But let's assume that it does it for the simplicity of this argument. I only think the good for the goose, good for the gander, or we're going to go after a Chinese company happens in specific cases where something's getting big that'll score you points. I don't think you're going to see any blanket. We're going to require every Chinese company to store their data in the United States.
Although I'm leaving the door open for my Joe Biden school uniforms thing with some TikTok restriction or demand. And or something
in fact,
like that.
To fight inflation, we're seeing pressure on the Biden administration to drop tariffs. A lot of the tariffs that were put in place by President Trump have remained, and there's finally some pressure to get rid of those to bring some prices down,
which the economy will make you do funny things. You know, Joe Biden was out there talking about how he was going to make Saudi Arabia the pariahs that they are. Yep. He's on a trip to Saudi Arabia next week. He said he was tougher on China than Trump, thinking about dropping the Chinese tariffs. And it's all because of inflation. I don't think that Biden does any of that if these core metrics aren't what they are.
A funny thing happened on the way to transitory inflation. It stuck around.
Exactly. Like a bad house guest, transitory inflation just kept hanging out.
Shouldn't you be going home? I'm just going to get bigger.
I did want to have this conversation because we've gone back and forth on this idea that it's more of a philosophical one. There was a complaint filed with the FCC. FEC, the Federal Elections Commission, about the relationship between the super PAC founded by and funded by Peter Thiel and the campaign of J.D. Vance in Ohio. Specifically, there was a Medium account that was public technically, in that anybody could type in the URL to it and they can find it. And by the way, you can still find it now. It is still up. But was not Googleable, was not searchable on Medium. The reason why is because it is illegal for a super PAC to communicate directly with a campaign. But if you are doing it in public, it is okay, which leads to the philosophical question, what on the internet is public and what is private? And obviously, there is a technical answer to that, which is if you have the URL, technically it is public. But I wanted to ask you, Tom, you know, we've been on the internet for a long time. We've seen a lot of philosophical questions of exactly, and we've seen things shift, things change on the internet very, very fast. What we might have thought as public, you know, before, we now probably think, because of the obscurity of the massive information, is more private. Do you think that those Medium pages, not technically, but morally, internet morals, was it public or private?
I've been thinking about this a lot since we first saw that story and talked about it to each other. If I were the judge, I would want to know the answer to this question. If this is public but hard to find, how did they find it?
Yeah.
So to me, if I can get a decent answer on that, I don't have to answer the thorny moral question of, like, you know, is a URL falls in the forest and no one's around, does anybody know it got clicked on? It would behoove a case to go after, how did you find it then? You turned off all of the search. You turned off all of the indexing. You basically made it so that if anyone knew the URL, they could get to it, but that's the only way they could get to it. Then how did they get to it? Because then the communication of that URL becomes the actionable part of that, becomes the thing you can say, well, all right, since you gave them that URL and that URL had to be given for someone to find it, I don't think it no longer meets the spirit of the definition of public, right? Because other than that, I start to run into security through obscurity is not security.
Yeah,
it only works for so long. And there are lots of ways someone can find something out. They can just guess. They can hack URLs. They can create a script that's like, give me Medium URLs and just run through all the combinations until you pull up one that has these keywords on it. So in the broad sense of, could you keep this from being found? No, there's lots of ways people could find it without you telling them.
Yeah.
So I go to specifically like, well, is that what happened? And then if they're like, yeah, they had a script and they just went through Medium, why did they do that? That is a fair thing to ask in court. Who gave them the idea to do that? I think you go after that, because what's going on is somebody's trying to get around the rules. And if you're a judge, you're trying to see if the rules still apply in any other way.
And this is something that happens regularly. And,
oh, sure.
And,
yeah.
And it is because of McCain-Feingold that super PACs cannot talk to campaigns. This, of course, has led to that happens almost exactly as the internet starts to get bigger and bigger. And now the easiest way to store your information in real time also becomes the easiest way that you can pass it, quote unquote, publicly while having it not be in front of everybody.
I mean, I guess if I were an originalist, I might look at it and say, you said public. The word public means it's out there. This is out there. Sorry. It's public.
That Daily Beast article didn't name the campaign. I'm going to assume it was Josh Mandel, the guy who lost to J.D. Vance, which is why they're complaining about it. But they found these pages early in the process, which also I thought was just made them such whiners that it's like, wait, so you had the plays they were going to run and you still lost.
How did they find them too, right? That's the other thing. Who tipped them off? Who gave them the URL? Did they run a script that just discovered them?
Or is it just the script? Because I would assume that until you said that, I hadn't thought of it, that like, oh, that's what they would do. They would just, you know, run a script that says, you know, all these keywords that they would be looking for. And then like, once you find it, when you go to the link, you know, you can clearly tell what this is. And it's a breakdown. It's effectively campaign emails between the two companies saying, here's what we're looking at. Here's what our numbers say. Here's what we believe that your talking point should be, because the PAC hires all the big talent. The PAC hires the campaign, the big money campaign directors, the big money, well, maybe not the campaign directors, but strategists, pollsters, editors. They do all their own kind of stuff because they can spend more and they have an unlimited amount that they can spend with a PAC. So I think that the idea of the script is fascinating, because that also means that, yeah, nothing is sacred. That means everyone's going to run a script for every race. Yeah. And now it's just whack-a-mole on which public blogging service you're using.
I'm hypothesizing that a script could be written. Maybe there's something about Medium that makes that difficult or whatever.
Hackers, get back to me. Script kiddies, get back to me. I feel like that's know if this is possible.
Likely possibility. And there's several avenues. I suggested guessing URLs, which could be problematic because there's real words in the URL, but I'm also guessing there's IDs and other ways and logs and things that are publicly accessible that you could get. So
in fact, I might offer a standing bounty if people want to find these things for me while these campaigns are going on.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Yeah.
I would, because
they're findable if they're not protected. If they're not password protected, they're absolutely findable.
Ooh, what do you think my bounty should be? How much do you think this is worth?
Do you still have those coins that you give people?
Oh,
you
buy them a drink? Yeah. You'll get 5 jury will buy you a drink tokens. In fact, that'll be it. 5 jury will buy you a drink token sent to you overnight mail if you get me any of these communications between PACs and campaigns. And I will say this. I won't publish them. I will mine them for my own content.
You'll never know.
Yeah,
You'll never know.
Eventually, I don't know. If your campaign annoys me enough, I might publish it. But otherwise, I'm here to call you smart or stupid.
Because to circle back around to the philosophical question, I haven't looked at the rule. So maybe the rule actually contemplates what I'm about to say. But what the rule is intending to say is you can't communicate unless it is publicized, unless it is, you know, everybody can see it, not just you. And that's what they're exploiting. Like, well, it's technically public, even if it's not publicized, that it's there. And that it, maybe the rule just needs to be written better.
So this is, and number one, nothing's going to happen here because the FEC, as Dave Leventhal has explained to us many, many times, is a totally toothless and useless organization that doesn't actually even hear cases because they often don't have enough people to do it.
I imagine there's more activity at an Elks Lodge these days than at an FEC.
It looks like Grand Central Station compared to the FEC. Yeah. However, if I were to rewrite the rules, understanding our modern technology, I would legalize the ability for PACs and campaigns to communicate with each other. They would just have to do it on and pick your platform. Don't get caught up in which platform, be it Teams or Discord or Slack, but one of these kinds of things. And in exchange, everybody on Earth can access it real time. They can see your campaigns and your PACs talking back and forth to each other. And that is, I think that, because that's what we want. We want to just know if we're not in a world where we're not going to be able to separate them, we're not going to be able to separate the money from the campaign.
As soon as you make that the rule,
John McCain and Russ Feingold,
there's going to be things they don't want to say in there. So they'll find some other way to communicate.
And that would be the thing, is that my thought would be, okay, well, that's easier to punish. If something happens that obviously should have been discussed.
Because you've defined it as you can say whatever you want here and nothing anywhere else.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter whether it's public or not.
Any conversation that you're having, it's like if there's an
problem with that is
the PAC runs and it's not discussed, then there's questions on why, like, immediately.
The problem is, though, the reason you say non-public is that you don't want to publish the PAC or punish the PAC for saying something in public to everyone that someone goes, well, the reason they're saying that is to get it over there. You want to say it's okay for you to say whatever you want in public.
Well, I mean, that, the other thing is it eliminates.
So you're kind of just extending public to another area at that point.
Well, basically, I'm just saying here's the legitimate way that you can do it public, and also like now we'll restrict the other stuff, and it also does take away the excuse of when a PAC runs a nasty ad that you know covers something really gross and grody that the campaign would never want to have their name on, and then. You know, the campaign gets all high and mighty and says, well, we're legally not allowed to talk to them. So we have no idea why they ran this thing calling my opponent a murderer. That's obviously a crazy thing. Be crazy if he was, though. I mean, let's all think about that. It's like, that's obviously disingenuous. I would just also like for them to cut the S when it comes to that.
Yeah. A lot of people are saying you're right.
Many people, Tom. Daily Tech News Show, 5 days a week. What else is on your docket these days?
Well, if you're into conversations like the one we're having right now, direct your podcast search to A Word with Tom Merritt starting June 30th. June 30th, it will first arrive. Hopefully, by the time this is published, we'll have a trailer up so you'll actually find it in the podcast apps. But A Word with Tom Merritt, the name inspired by Justin Robert Young, in a conversation I had with you. It's just me sitting down and talking with people about something for about an hour. And we try to approach it with the idea of not, here's what to think. It's not a how-to or an explainer. It's how do we think about things? How do we sift through all the information? How do we decide what to believe? So the first episode's coming June 30th with a guy who's been doing political coverage for a long time. So it'll be very interesting to this audience. His name is Andrew Heaton.
Ah, the great and powerful Andrew Heaton.
Yeah. And our word for that first episode will be tribalism.
Oh, look at that. I like the gimmick. I love it. A word.
And then following on that, I've got Professor David Broadbeck talking about free will. Lamar Wilson, YouTube creator, talking about creator, and Annalie Newitz, the author and writer, and all around smart person, talking about categories. So those will be the first four episodes. Again, the show is called A Word with Tom Merritt.
I cannot wait. Tom, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Ben.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. This show was edited by Brett Stewart. If you'd like to say thank you to Tom Merritt, it is px3guest.com, letter P, letter X, number 3, guest.com. Send us an email, theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Our Twitter is px3tweets. Find me live on the internet, px3live.com. Our podcast is px3podcast.com, and you can find our merch at politicsmerch.com. Support me with a one-time donation, paypal.me/payjury. Venmo is justin-young-20, and our Cash App is px3cash. Send me anything that you would like physically in the mail. Make it out to Justin Young, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. Of course, you can always get our bonus content at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And the $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the show like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. V-Guard Alexis, Neil of Neils, MC Dradio, Unsafe DB Levels, Katie, Double K Ranch, Amanda, Ye Old Pinball Shop, John, DP4 Bongo, Niemeister, Nick's Horseless Diner, Catherine, Persons Familiar with the Matter, and Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. 100 Mile Runner, Edison, Up, Up, Down, Down, Left, Right, BA Start, Dr. G, Headphones, Neil, Charles, Darren, Idris Arslandian, Bluefront, and the Lenina, DL, Steven, Chad, Nomadic Terran, Diana Shrill Shrieks, Miranda Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul is awesome, Brad, Richard, D. Laser, Just Another Pilot, Middle-Aged Mike, who loves Frank Got Abducted, Utah Jimmy Montana, The Gen, Adam L., D. Really, Chopper, J. Pink, Andrew, and Joshua. That's it. If you would like your name there, head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. And that wraps it up for us today. We should have some fun stuff. I'm working on some stuff for next week, including wrapping up Pride Month. There's been an interview I've been chasing that is Pride-centric about gay Washington that I'm very excited about, just because that town is obviously fascinating. And the subculture there, I think, would be very rich with storytelling possibilities. And boy, well, I don't know what I'm recording this on Wednesday. So there may or may not have been a thing at the beginning of this episode because of the Supreme Court. I presume we will do our biggest digging on that next week. So please enjoy that. Although I almost certainly talked about it if it happened on yesterday's Patreon episode. So keep your antenna tuned. Till then, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss O3.
Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.